8 minutes after seven, and to tell us what it says in Tuesday's papers is Deirdre Purcell.
Eric Luke's picture of a huge placard complete with skull and crossbones and emblazoned with the words "No to giant sewage plant" creates the headline for this morning's main story on the front page of the Irish Times. Dan Griffin's report underneath tells us that plans for a regional treatment plant announced by Fingal County Council yesterday for Clonshach, 2 kilometres from Dublin Airport, has ignited local protests, with local TD Tommy Brown concurring with the 10,000 residents who have lodged objections, saying the decision was a total disaster for the area. The project engineers, however, say that the work on the site chosen would be the most ecologically sensitive of the choices available, would cost less than other sites proposed, and will discharge effluent deeper into the water from a shorter pipeline. The Irish Examiner leads with its report on the recommendations of the Law Reform Commission that, as you've heard in the bulletin, recommends changes in some mandatory sentencing, including that for drug dealing. In that instance, the Commission recommends the replacement of the present mandatory 10-year sentence with structured guidelines drawn up by a judicial council. This proposal has been welcomed by those running drug projects, according to reporter Cormac O'Keefe. The lead in the Irish Independent is written by Fia Kelly and Lisa Hand and expands somewhat on yesterday's story concerning TD John McGuinness, that we're told that there is growing pressure on him to step down from his chairmanship of the Public Accounts Committee. Since his party leader, Micheál Martin, who was Minister for Trade and Enterprise in 2007, dismissed Mr McGuinness's request that his wife be allowed travel with him on a trade mission, the writer of The Independent's main editorial finds it difficult to understand how the Fianna Fáil leader can now stand behind his colleague. For the lead story in the Irish Daily Mail, Laura Linnett has spoken to Tom Curran, the partner of Mary Fleming, the woman who has so far failed in her court bids to enable him legally to assist her when the time comes to take her own life. Mr Curran told the paper he has received advice from the head of the suicide information group, Exit International. Inside the Examiner, Anne O'Loughlin tells us that Ian Bailey's partner, Jules Thomas, is seeking access to state files for her action against the state for damages arising out of the Gorda investigation into the death of Sophie Toscan Duplantier. Last month, we're told, Mr Bailey himself was granted such an order. The Irish Daily Star leads with the devastation of a rape victim whose attacker was given a suspended sentence so he could look after his disabled children. And the Irish Sun lead tells us that Gordy have confirmed an investigation into a threat to harm Enda Kenny. The threat was posted on a website set up to support a campaign to save the Sacred Heart Hospital, Castlebar. But here comes the news, sad for his legions of Irish fans, that Colonel Chris Hadfield, who thrilled us all with his tweets, snaps, musings and music from the International Space Station during his 5-month stint in space, has retired from his 35-year career as a fighter pilot and astronaut. He described his command of the ISS as a kind of pinnacle of my entire career. You can read about it in the Herald, amongst other pages. But the Herald leads with the bravery of two women who were serving customers in the Genoa chip shop in Balbriggan when two masked raiders, armed with a knife and a metal bar, ran in and attempted to climb over the counter to rob the till. Victoria Pronina and Erica Loughran responded with a barrage of vinegar bottles and salt shakers, and the would-be robbers ran off.
Deirdre, thank you for that. Emma McNamara is here now with News of Business. Good morning, Emma.
Thanks, Fran. Groupon, known for local deals, goods and getaways, is looking for 20 new staff at its software development centre in Dublin. The positions are for software engineers, programmers, data scientists and college graduates. Groupon already employs about 12 people in Dublin and has more than 10,000 staff in 48 countries. And the new positions will be filled by the end of the year, and Groupon expects to further increase their investment in months to come. At its Worldwide Developers Conference, where Apple gets to show off its new operating systems so developers will write applications for them before they launch, the company unveiled new mobile software in what it called the biggest overhaul of the iPhone and iPad system since it was introduced in 2007. It also introduced a new MacBook or Mac Pro, its top-of-the-line computer, which will be made in the United States. Here's Dan Gallagher from MarketWatch in San Francisco.
What we saw today is essentially how the new iPhone, a glimpse of how they're going to work. What we didn't see is what the actual new devices might look like. But the software is a very important step. They've never changed the look of iOS really since the first iPhone came out. It's sort of looked the same. They've added lots of new capabilities. So what they did today is that they gave it a real significant redesign. It looks different. It'll work differently in some ways. This is kind of the first time they've done this with their operating system for the mobile devices. I think people who like using Apple products will be interested in something new. You know, whether it spurs a lot more people who haven't bought their products to buy them, I think we'll have to wait and see on that.
Market Watch's Dan Gallagher speaking earlier this morning from San Francisco. And ratings agency Fitch has warned that AIB Group and Bank of Ireland may need to raise further capital in the future. Mortgage arrears costs and the need for stronger capital reserves will make it harder for the banks to return to profitability, Fitch said, adding that it expects impairment charges to rise this year and peak next year. It said the banks will not return to operating profitability until 2015 at the earliest. And on the currency markets this morning, the euro is trading at $1.3263 and at 85 pence sterling.
Emma, thank you. Riot police have moved in Taksim Square this morning. We'll have the latest from Turkey next.
You listen to Morning Ireland at just after 7:15. The Turkish Prime Minister Tayyip Erdogan had agreed yesterday to meet some of the protest organisers who've been involved in demonstrations in the city centre in Taksim Square for the past week on Wednesday. This is tomorrow. But any idea that that would mean that the authorities would hold off was obviously incorrect, as has been shown by events in Istanbul in the last couple of hours. We're joined from Istanbul by journalist David O'Byrne. David, what exactly have the authorities done in Taksim Square?
Well, it seems that the police have moved into the square. They've broken down the barricades which had been erected around the square by some of the protest groups. And they've dispersed the protesters who were camped around the Ataturk monument, which is in the middle of the square. And they're removing the huge placards that had been, they've removed all the placards that had been erected around the monument. And they're removing those which have been hung from buildings around the square. But it seems that they've left the original protesters, the ones who were in the park to the north side, it seems they've left those alone.
So is it clear yet to what extent this protest is going to continue?
I'm about 600 or 700 metres away from the square, but I can't actually see anything from where I am. But what's been announced by the Istanbul governor, it seems that they're going to allow the protesters who are in the Gezi Park itself to remain. But they're forcing the other protest groups, the ones who've taken over large areas of the square and areas around the square, which includes a lot of marginal left-wing groups, they're forcing those out of the square. And the police are moving back in there. I'm just watching some footage of there are clashes between police and protesters going on in some parts of the square at the moment. Not in the park itself, but on the fringes of the square. And some of the protesters seem to be throwing Molotov cocktails, which does tend to confirm some of the allegations made about them.
How many hours ago did this operation start?
It seems to have been about 2 hours ago.
And any idea yet whether anyone's been hurt?
No, I haven't seen any reports yet about injuries, or it would seem inevitable.
How would you put in context this police operation to remove a large number of the demonstrators, put beside the Prime Minister's willingness to meet some of the protest leaders tomorrow?
Well, that's a good question. The announcement yesterday evening that the Prime Minister Tayyip Erdogan was prepared to meet with some of the protesters surprised everybody. It went against all everything that he'd been saying for the previous 10 days. He'd been particularly bellicose and aggressive in his criticism of the protesters and his denials of everything that they claimed that he was planning to do, i.e. to destroy the park and rebuild a 19th century Ottoman barracks. His announcement that he was prepared to meet with them came as something as a surprise. And I have to say, now it looks as if this was some sort of trick designed for the protesters to lower their guard. How it will sit with the wider Istanbul or wider Turkish population, I don't know. The initial protest started, when was it, nearly 2 weeks ago, with a very small group of people occupying a very small park area to the north of Taksim, and it was the violence shown against them by the police in their removal that caused several hundred thousand people to march on Taksim Square the following Saturday. What will happen now, I really don't know. I'm sure that there's going to be some kind of response from people in Istanbul.
Well, David O'Byrne in Istanbul, thank you very much for taking our call. 719.
Well, it has all the elements of a screenplay or a Hollywood blockbuster. It's, of course, the prison program and those US links. And the man behind the leaks, which revealed the prison program to the world, has checked out of his Hong Kong hotel room this morning. Edward Snowden's whereabouts now unknown. The program involves the US government gathering huge volumes of data from internet companies. All types of data are being gathered, and it's widely viewed as a significant breach of people's privacy. The affair could have widespread implications, most notably to EU-US trade negotiations, which are taking place. The European Commission's Vice President, Viviane Reding, is set to raise the issue again at an EU-US meeting, which is planned in Dublin on Thursday. The Commission spokeswoman is Mina Andreeva, and she's on the line. Good morning.
Good morning.
How important is the US respecting the European Union's privacy law to the European Commission this week in particular, with all of this coming up, Mina?
Well, in the European Union, the protection of personal data is a fundamental right, which is described in our EU Charter for Fundamental Rights, so our Bill of Rights, if you want. The respect of fundamental rights and the rule of law are the foundation of the EU-US relationship. We see already today that around 70% of EU citizens are concerned that their personal data held by companies could be used for a purpose other than the one for which it was collected. So I think that this prison scandal is likely to reinforce this shaken trust of EU citizens, and it would be in the interest of US companies as well to make sure that citizens trust the digital economy and the digital services, because otherwise they will not be likely to give away their data. And we know data is the currency of today's digital economy.
If the US continues to stand over the prison program, which sees it harvest this vast amount of data, is it something which could potentially present issues before the EU striking a deal with the US on trade negotiations?
I think it is very clear that data protection will not be part of the negotiations on a free trade agreement, because data protection is a fundamental right. This is not about technical standards, and the European Commission is not ready to lower its standards of protection. Therefore, it is very clear that this will not be part of the free trade negotiations. We're negotiating data protection on a separate track with the United States. From 2011, from March 2011, Vice President Reding, the EU's Justice Chief, has been mandated to negotiate a general agreement with the United States on protecting personal data in the field of police and judicial cooperation. So this is the right track. And in parallel, the European Union is working on its own strong EU data protection rules to update what we have already since 1995, however, when the internet was still in its infancy. So we are updating our own rules to make them better for the citizens. And we are also working with the United States to strike the right deal that grants high level of protection to EU and US citizens alike.
Are you concerned, is the Commission concerned, that internet companies based in the European Union are being subject to the prison program, that data which they are handling on behalf of EU citizens could be subject to the prison program? Is that a point of concern for the Commission, which it's likely to raise with the US government?
The European Commission is indeed very concerned about possible consequences on EU citizens' privacy, and we will seek more details on these issues from the US authorities. Vice President Reding will travel to Dublin on the 13th of June, and there is the EU-US Ministerial Summit on Thursday and Friday, where she will address this with her American counterparts. But let's be clear, this legal issue is not a new one. The European Commission has been raising this with the US authorities within the negotiations of the EU-US Data Protection Agreement already since almost 2 years, because we have been saying that whereas in the US legal system only US citizens and residents benefit from constitutional safeguards, in the European Union everyone's personal data and the confidentiality of their communications are protected as a fundamental right.
Yeah,
so it doesn't depend on nationality.
You say it's not new, but you would admit that it those concerns are bound to have been significantly heightened in the past week or so with the revelations in The Guardian about exactly what the US government has been up to.
Indeed, it is interesting that now this scandal makes itself to the media, although, as I say, the last time the Commission raised this, it was in April. Nobody seemed to take note of this. I think this case very clearly shows that we need a legal framework for the protection of personal data, and this is not a luxury or not a constraint. This is a necessity, and this is about protecting the fundamental rights of our citizens. This is exactly the spirit of the EU's data protection reform, and this is the spirit of our negotiations with the United States on a data protection agreement.
You say the Vice President of the Commission, Vivian Reding, is to raise the issue with her counterparts in the US. At how high a level will that happen? Because the Attorney General in the US, Eric Holder, is in Dublin on the 13th. Are discussions likely to go as high as that?
Indeed, the Vice President is intending to raise this issue with US Attorney General Eric Holder, as she did already last April in Washington.
Okay. Mina Andreeva, European Commission spokeswoman, thank you for joining us this morning. The time now is approaching 26 minutes after 7.
We're going to look now at this error which has been acknowledged by the State Exams Commission in the mathematics paper, the higher level maths paper for the Leaving Cert yesterday. The Commission has said that when the papers are corrected, the error will be taken into account to ensure that no candidates are disadvantaged. Joining us now is Catherine Lewis, who teaches maths at Rathdown School in Dublin. She's also a member of the Council of the Irish Maths Teachers Association. Good morning and thanks for coming in.
Good morning.
And I know you were at a meeting of maths teachers to discuss the paper, as usual, in Dublin last night. What was the error and what was its effect?
Right. Basically, on the English version of the paper, there were two errors. One error was, if you read the English language, it says that the ship turns through an angle of 124 degrees, which would mean that that should be an exterior angle to the triangle. In the diagram, it is an interior angle. However, most students would just go straight to the diagram and work from the diagram. And that was fine. You start working from the diagram. It seems a very easy question. And many students, and I want to reassure them on this, they would have dropped the vertical down, used the basic idea of the sine is the opposite of the hypotenuse, and got a value for the height of the triangle. Very good students, however, might have wondered why such a trivial question was on an honours Leaving Cert paper. So they might have checked their answer, which can be done on a calculator in 2 seconds, using the other side of the triangle, and then you get a different answer. And then the very good students start wondering, you know, the same triangle can't have two different heights.
So what did it do to some of your... You seem to be saying the better you are, the better at maths you are, the more likely you are to find the problem and be thrown by it.
Well, I will put it to you this way. I was meeting my students after the exam and one of my very good students came to me afterwards. And one of the first things she said to me was, I couldn't find the height of the triangle. And I didn't have the paper then to have a look at. So when I went home and I had a copy of the paper and I went through it and I followed the diagram and I did it. And I thought, why is she having such a problem with this? Didn't make sense to me. So I did the check. And then I suddenly found that doing it one way, you get an answer of about 47, whatever it is, kilometres. The other way, you get an answer of 37 kilometres. That's a big difference.
Now, I know you didn't have anyone doing it through Irish, but you were at this meeting where obviously teachers who were dealing with students who took it through Irish. If you were doing it through Irish, was there no problem?
Well, there was a problem, yes, because in the Irish paper, as I understand it, the angle of 36 degrees was left out. Now, the problem on the English paper is that the triangle is not consistent. The triangle doesn't work. Okay. The 36 degrees is a wrong angle.
Yeah, but in Irish?
In Irish, they didn't put it in, so they could have worked out the question. However, the invigilators were alerted to the fact that it was missing the angle of 36 degrees. So they, as I understand it, announced to the students to put in the angle of 36 degrees.
So everyone had
the same problem.
OK, well, we'll see what they make of that. Now, I know you want to talk about a number of problems with other papers. Let's talk particularly, you mentioned two, the ordinary level pilot school leaving cert. This is a pilot project in some schools, not in all.
Yes. Before Project Maths was introduced to all schools in the country, I think it was in the beginning, 24 schools piloted it for 3 years to hopefully iron out some of the problems, see some of the issues. Right.
So we know we're talking about the correct term for it is what?
These are the pilot schools.
Yeah. So what's it called?
What, Project Maths? Our maths course is Project Maths.
Okay.
There's nothing other than Project Maths now,
but,
effectively.
But this is only in some schools.
But this refers to, there is at the Leaving Cert, about 20% of the Leaving Cert paper on paper one was different to everyone else's. Okay. Everyone had the same paper two. Paper one, the calculus section, was different between the pilot schools and the rest of the country.
In the pilot schools, what was the problem?
Ordinary level pilot school, there was a 25 mark question broken up into A, B and C. The problem was that part B and part C are from the old syllabus. They're not on the Project Maths
so
syllabus.
People were asked a question that they wouldn't have prepared for or studied for?
No, not at all.
Big problem.
Big problem for them.
Representing how many marks?
Well, if I were giving this exam, it would have represented 80% was not on the syllabus.
Okay. The other problem was with the Leaving Certificate Foundation Level paper.
Yes, there was a problem with the Leaving Certificate Foundation Level paper, question 5, the nets of a pyramid and the surface area of a pyramid, both of which are not on the syllabus. There was also in question 10A a foundation notation incorrect, something incorrect. On Leaving Certificate Paper 2, Project Maths Phase 1, 6B, Constructions of Transformations are not on the syllabus. Again, this is only for the pilot schools. Leaving Certificate Higher Level Paper 1, the only integration was asked, the integration of sign, which is no longer on the syllabus.
OK, the serious problems, obviously. The first thing is to remind anyone or anyone's parents who's listening is that the Commission will take all of this into account.
Yes.
But having said that, is this a particularly bad year?
I think it is reflective of what a lot of teachers have been saying. The syllabus is not detailed enough. It's not clear enough. We are also dealing with the fact that in 2012, 2013, 2014 and 2015, we have slightly different syllabuses at Leaving Cert and Junior Cert, honours on ordinary level. And it's small bits that are changing from one to another. So it's very easy to make mistakes. So the maths teachers have been looking for greater clarity of the syllabus. A much more detailed syllabus, and we have been told, no, we can't have that.
But in the meantime, the State Exam Commission have a lot to do to sort all this out. More than usual.
Well, I have never, in 20 years of going to these meetings, have so many errors come up. You know, there are a lot of small errors. Perhaps... It would seem to me, if I were doing this at a level at school and I'd produced a paper like this, it would be because I was in a rush and I hadn't had enough time I did it.
All right, food for thought. Catherine Lewis, math teacher in Rathdown School, thank you very much for talking to us. I won't say you made everything clear, but then how could you? It is very complicated, but you've made it pretty clear, considering. Thank you very much.
22 minutes to 8 o'clock and Darren Frehel is here with sport. Darren.
Good morning to you, Fran. The British and Irish Lions continue their build-up to their first test against Australia with a game against the Queensland and New South Wales country combined 15 this morning. They're a semi-professional outfit and the team are the weakest opposition the Lions are likely to face on this particular tour. Just 8 of the starting team have Super 15 experience. The Lions team, of course, includes Brian O'Driscoll, Conor Murray, Sean O'Brien and Jamie Heaslip. Rory Best is on the bench. Simon Zebo has joined up with the Lions squad in Sydney and our rugby commentator expects him and Rob Kearney to get some action in the game against the Waratahs on Saturday.
Yes, Simon Zebo arrived earlier in Sydney. He's actually travelled up to Newcastle to link up with the squad ahead of tonight's game against the combined country. In actual fact, he could feature at some stage either in the starting team or off the bench against the Waratahs in Sydney on Saturday. In relation to Rob Kearney, well, he stepped up his training over the last number of days. As you know, his hamstring has caused him to miss the opening games on tour so far, but he's expected to be in contention for the game against the Waratahs also. Regarding Tommy Bowe, he's going to have his injured hand re-examined later on in the week. He had a metal plate inserted in it. The main concern at the moment seems to be whether the wound can heal quickly or otherwise. I know that Warren Gatland is anxious to allow Tommy time to get back to full fitness. So, you know, we'll be keeping a watching brief on this over the next couple of days.
We'll have more from Michael in Sydney in the next hour. Today's match kicks off at 10:40 a.m. It's live on Radio 1, Longwave 252 and across our digital platforms. The Republic of Ireland plays Spain in New York in the early hours of tomorrow morning. Now, the Irish manager Giovanni Trapattoni has announced his starting team to face the World and European champions at Yankee Stadium. David Ford starts in goal. The back four is Paul McShane, Sean St. Ledger, Darren O'Dea and Stephen Kelly. Seamus Coleman switches to midfield and he'll play alongside Jeff Hendrick, who starts his first Irish game. James McCarthy and Andy Keogh also in that midfield partnership. Robbie Keane will partner Conor Salmon up front. The Derby striker is relishing the chance of starting up front with the Irish skipper and playing the best team in the world.
Yeah, I'm really enjoying playing alongside someone like Robbie, who's, and even training alongside him. You know, the career he's already had and he's continuing to have as well, the records he's breaking, and yeah, it's an absolute pleasure to link up with him, and yeah, very excited at the kind of prospect, and against it, you know, doesn't get much better than the Spanish national team, the squad of players that they've got to pick from, so it'll be a real test for us and test myself against the best kind of.
And that game gets underway tomorrow morning. It's 1 a.m. Irish time. And if you're not staying up late for that one in the early hours of tomorrow morning, we'll have a report on it and loads of reaction here in Morning Ireland tomorrow morning. There was one match in the Airtricity League Premier Division last night. Drogheda beat Dundalk 1-0. Patrick Hoban's goal separated the sides. The draw for the quarterfinals of the EA Sports Cup took place last night. Bohemians will face Derry. Drogheda take on Cork, Shamrock Rovers will play St Patrick's Athletic and Limerick will face Sligo Rovers. Tiger Woods and Sergio Garcia shook hands on the practice range at Merion Golf Club ahead of the US Open this week. It's the first time the players have met since Garcia's fried chicken comments last month. The US Open has gotten off to a wet start. As much as 5 inches of rain has soaked the 117-year-old course over the last 4 days. Yesterday's practice round was postponed at 3 o'clock local time. More than 100 volunteers have been drafted in to help groundskeepers get the course ready for Thursday's first round. Dan Martin will go into today's stage of the Tour of Switzerland in 7th place overall. He's 1 minute and 23 seconds off the lead held by Matthias Frank. Nicholas Roach is 20th overall. And finally, there's racing this evening in Roscommon and the action there gets underway at 5:15.
What is the European Central Bank legally entitled to do to protect the euro and bond yields in the eurozone? According to Mario Draghi, the bank's governor, the answer is, as he put it last July, whatever it takes. This has to some extent gone off our radar, particularly as Irish bond yields have come down to a much more tolerable level. But it is a very real issue for the entire eurozone. And that answer and everything that flows from Mario Draghi's statement, whatever it takes, is going to come under scrutiny in a case which is going to start today at the Federal Constitutional Court in Germany, which meets in Karlsruhe. And to look at that case and the possible implications, we're joined now, excuse me, by the German legal affairs correspondent of Bloomberg, Karin Matusek. Thanks for taking the call. What exactly is the issue which the court has to decide, Karin?
Well, the court has first to decide whether it can hear a case that is attacking the European Central Bank and its bond purchasing program or its bond purchasing plan. And then if it decides that it can hear, it can rule on such a case. It has to look at whether, you know, the bond purchasing plan is in line with European law. And even if it comes to the conclusion that it may not be in line with European law, it still has to rule on whether it's such a grave violation that it can intervene from the German level.
It's very difficult to assess where a court is going to go beforehand, but whatever about the possibility of a no, I don't know whether you regard that as likely or possible, is the answer in terms of what, of whether this is acceptable or not. In other words, what the European Central Bank is doing. Is it quite likely to be, yes, you can do it, but, and then add terms and conditions?
Yeah, that's what most legal experts in Germany say will happen. The court has never stopped any step of European integration, any step like the Maastricht Treaty or the introduction of the euro. Everything was challenged in this court, and the court has always said, well, it's problematic to a certain extent, but, you know, you can go ahead, but please make sure this and this, and keep this and this in mind. This is a safeguard. This is what happened last year when the court cleared the European Stability Mechanism, which is part of this case. And legal experts also expect that this will happen this time too, because the court shuns from intervening into economic policies, and, you know, they don't want to be held responsible for causing trouble on the financial markets.
Well, there's another thing that arises, and this is a layperson's question. How come a German court is deciding whether an action taken by a European body, an EU body, whether that's okay or not?
Yeah, many people ask that question, a lot of Europeans. But Germans, when they signed the EU treaties, they agreed to a limited program of what can be done. And they say now the European court, the European Central Bank is overstepping those limits. So we didn't agree to the things that they are planning now. That's the basic argument. And if they don't keep to the treaty, we have to be able to sue against it. And we have to, technically, they sue the German government, and they want the German government to intervene to stop the European Central Bank. That's basically it.
Politically, this looks like it's going to be a very significant case with, for example, Wolfgang Schäuble, the Minister for Finance, being one of several high-profile witnesses who will be appearing before the court.
Yes. Yes. Schäuble will be there, the finance minister, and Asmussen from the European Central Bank, and also Jens Weidmann, the president of the German Bundesbank.
How long will this take?
The complete day today, and most of the day tomorrow, I think.
All right, it was going to be a very interesting case, particularly in a German election year. But Karen, thank you very much for talking to us. 14 minutes to 8.
Morning, Ireland, 12 minutes to 8 o'clock. Well, if you're finding it hard to get going this morning, spare a thought for our next guest, because for the past 9 days, 23 hours, 31 minutes and 56 seconds, he's been rowing constantly along with his crew. Gavin Sheehan is taking part in a 2,000-mile non-stop rowing race around the British mainland. We go live now to the Black Oyster, which is somewhere, we're told, off the Dublin coast. Gavin, how has the race been so far?
It's been difficult, good, exciting, and at the moment falling into the taxing bracket. We're just coast of Dublin at the moment. And there's a bit of an easterly breeze blowing, and it's making life a small bit difficult, but we're keeping the bright side out.
Communications aren't easy either, because you're talking to us on a satellite phone. The sound is a little intermittent and there's a slight delay, but I'm sure people understand that when you're rowing for 9 days at this stage and at sea at the moment, things aren't easy. Tell us about the race and this. I suppose you're trying to beat a specific record. Just how difficult are conditions?
Conditions are difficult at the moment. In the IRC, last night we were looking at kind of 15 to 20 foot swell and a breeze busting across the boat at about maybe 18 knots. So life was a bit difficult, especially in our little boat. It's only about 23 feet long and about a metre and a half wide. So it's not exactly a super yacht. It'll bounce around the place.
What?
And when you can't see the rolling waves coming at you, it makes life a bit difficult.
What about the other teams taking part? How many people are involved, and how competitive is this race?
Well, we started 9 days ago. There were 7 boats entered in, and we all left from Towerbridge. And there's actually only been 2 boats to complete this race in its history, the race being run. And up until today, there's actually only 2 boats out of the 7 that started left, ourselves and the men's pair, and they're only just kind of down around the Land's End area. So difficult. It's difficult to even start and finish it, let alone try and do what we're doing, which is try and crack the current world record to go around it, which was set in 2005 by the former British Marine.
Yeah, I was looking at the website and it's saying that more people have landed on the moon than have rode around Britain, which really, I suppose, gives you an idea of just how tough it is. What about the prize that's in prospect and the cost of funding a trip like this?
Well, we were very lucky in the sense of our sponsors. It was myself and three friends, were all kind of about 23, 24 years of age. And up until 10 weeks ago, we didn't have a boat, we didn't have any funding. And well, some of the teams have been preparing for up to 12 months. And we just got very, very lucky. And you're talking kind of around £50,000 between the boat, food, foul weather clothing, which we're getting used to today, and different bits and pieces like that we need to get around the island.
Now, you yourself are an All-Ireland rowing champion. You're fairly determined and so are your team. If all goes according to plan, when would you expect to finish?
We're hoping to finish. The current record is, as you said, it's about 26 days, 14 hours and 11 minutes. And we're hoping to do it in a couple of minutes less than that, I'd be happy with. But the sooner we can get back to Tower Bridge, the better, which we reckon is about kind of, 14 days time.
Okay, very good. Gavin, best of luck to you and to the whole team as well on the race, and hopefully you don't make it back to Tower Bridge too soon because it'll mean the race for you is over. Gavin Sheehan there joining us as he rows and his team rows and the crew rows on the Black Oyster somewhere off the coast of Dublin. It's 8 minutes to 8 o'clock and Emma McNamara is back with news, business news.
Thanks, Fran. A report urging the British Chancellor George Osborne to hand out shares in Royal Bank of Scotland and Lloyds to the public was described by the British Treasury as quite robust and well-researched. Mr Osborne is expected to set out his ambition to return the two banks to the private sector next week, with the Treasury eyeing a possible start of that process with a disposal of 10% of Lloyds shares this year. Royal Bank of Scotland owns Ulster Bank here. We're joined now by Justin Urquhart-Stewart of Seven Investment Management in London. Justin, how could those bank shares go directly to taxpayers?
Well, the system they were coming up with was actually a rather strange mechanism whereby it would be handed out to taxpayers and they would be paying for it as and when actually the share price recovers and actually start seeing a profit on it. This is a faintly ridiculous scheme. We've been through privatisations before and this is just trying to make life even more complicated. But for banks like RBS to find themselves potentially with up to 40 million shareholders would be an absolute nightmare. So I don't think they really have thought it through very well. This is a politically conceived populist mechanism to try and actually give away the shares and give away some cash to the population prior to an election, I suspect. So the chance of this operating in this particular way, I think, is unlikely. But again, we're dealing with politicians, so who knows?
It might be described as robust and well-researched by the British Treasury, but what do you think the public appetite for RBS and Lloyd's shares would be?
Well, the public appetite for anyone offering free money is always quite enthusiastic, I suspect. Had they actually sat down and thought about what they would be given, which is the potential for shares in banks which are not doing very well, then I think they might think again. Privatisations we had here back in the 70s and 80s, or in the 80s and 90s, really showed that actually people weren't actually for long-term shareholders. They saw it as an opportunity to be given some shares at a discounted price and then sell them, make some money. It didn't actually create a broader portfolio. Therefore, offering people shares in one stock, and not a very good stock at that, probably isn't the best thing to try and do. There must be better ways of actually trying to actually pass this. Better that I suspect that the government take a longer term view and look to hold these companies in under the realms of the Bank of England for 10 years and then sell them back into the market with a very healthy profit indeed.
Now, recent figures show that Ulster Bank accounted for about one in every £4 of losses at Royal Bank of Scotland since 2008. What do you think its future within the group is?
It's going to stay there for the moment because actually RBS doesn't have any choice. Whether it actually folds into what should have been done 3 or 4 years ago, as of course you in Ireland are very familiar with the bad bank concept of NAMA and such like, well, I doubt whether they're being allowed to do that now by the European Union authorities. So I think RBS is effectively stuck with it for the moment. What would it like to do? The answer is we'd love to get rid of it, but at what cost and how would it actually manage it? So it's just going to have to write off those costs and be able to actually try and see if it can restructure it in due course.
There's been talk of selling it or passing it on to the Irish government, but given the ratings agency Fitch's warning about the Irish banking system yesterday, how welcome do you think another bank would be?
I'm sure the Irish government, the last thing they'd want to have is another bank in difficulties like that. So I would have thought that's a rather nasty game of pass the parcel and wait till the music stops. I would actually not wish to enter that game at all if I were them. Take a swift step back. What we're seeing, of course, in Ireland is a recovery, but of course the recovery coming through may not be felt on the street at the moment, but it's not up to necessarily being reflected in the banks yet either. Because, of course, this is the moment, of course, when you start seeing some recovery that actually more losses start coming to light, and where banks have a habit of pulling the plug on companies as well. So it's going to be a very sensitive time for banking at the moment as we start moving into some soft recovery, but it's still going to be very difficult for them, and they're going to be very capital constrained.
And briefly, Justin, as the economies start to improve, how is it that bad debts become more apparent?
Well, what happens is, as things begin to pick up, then banks will pull the rug, because then the assets, which they couldn't have got rid of when it was flat on its back, now may have some value. So this is the time when you start seeing the insolvency practitioners baring their teeth, because they can start seeing assets which may be coming available have a value at last, and the banks feel they're going to get some money back for it.
OK, Justin Urquhart-Stewart of Seven Investment Management in London. Thanks very much for joining us this morning. To currencies, the euro is trading at $1.32.6 and 85 pence sterling.
Emma, thank you. It's a little bit wetter outside today, but here now with the latest weather forecast is Joan Blackburn.
Thanks and good morning everyone from Met Erin. Well, indeed, it's a big difference across the country this morning on recent mornings, with generally overcast, misty skies and spells of rain. Now, we had a lot of rain overnight, and we still have persistent and heavy rain through parts of Ulster, Connacht and parts of North Leinster. However, over the southern half of the country, the rain has turned more scattered and generally lighter, with dry periods, but very misty, especially on hills and coasts. This somewhat drier conditions will tend to spread northwards through the morning, but the persistent rain could well hold on in more northern districts. Most places then will tend to become drier for a time, even some brighter short sunny spells developing, but still some patchy rain about. Then later on this afternoon, it looks like another band of persistent and heavy rain will return into parts of the southwest and west. Top temperatures today, 15 to 19 degrees. Heavy rain this evening and for a time tonight, especially in parts of the west and northwest, but the rain will become more scattered and lighter overnight. The winds will be very light inland. It'll be a very misty night with fog in places around dawn. Lowest overnight temperatures, 11 or 12 degrees. And the outlook is for very unsettled weather. The temperatures normal or a little bit below, and we are likely to see spells of heavy rain at times. Some details. Very mild and humid tomorrow. There'll be good dry periods during the morning with just showery rain about. However, heavier spells are likely in the afternoon and evening with the risk of some thundery downpours locally. Highs tomorrow, 16 to 19 or possibly 20 degrees. Winds light for much of the day, but then a fresh west to northwesterly will develop later. Bright and fresh on Thursday, some sunny spells and scattered showers mostly in the west and north. Cloudy, damp conditions with rain will spread into southern districts during the afternoon and evening. The latest indications suggest wet weather developing on Friday, with widespread rain spreading northwards and the risk of some strong winds later. But this giving way to brighter, blustery conditions on Saturday, with sunny spells and scattered showers. Sunday looks like being fairly cool, but dry and bright in many areas. However, heavy rain could well move into southern parts as the day goes on. That's all for me. Good morning.